Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is part one of a two-part podcast with Baroness Helena Kennedy. She was so funny, so fascinating, that we couldn't edit it down, so we decided to have a two-parter. Sit back and enjoy Baroness Helena Kennedy, part one.
The judge is reading this out, How to Make a Molotov Cocktail. And he says, is this the sort of book that you have on your coffee table? To me. And I said, but my Lord, it's a bit like having the Kama Sutra. The fact that you've got it doesn't mean that you do all the things.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a renowned barrister and member of the House of Lords. She's built a career on showing compassion in the courtroom. As a member of the House of Lords, she has fought endlessly for women's rights and against misogyny. She has served as the chair for Charter 88, the Human Genetics Commission, the Power Inquiry, and the British Council. She has played a hand in the country's biggest cases, from the Brighton bombing to the Guildford Four appeal. When she's not advocating for equality and fighting for freedoms, you can find her captivating crowds on stage, on the screen, and over the airways as a presenter for programmes like Heart of the Matter, Time, Gentlemen, Please, and Blind Justice. She is truly a champion of social justice who leads with passion, wit, and humanity. Baroness Helena Kennedy, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
It's lovely to be here, Paul.
Well, it's such a pleasure to see you, and I'm a huge fan of your work. Firstly, I'd like to take you back to the early years when you were growing up in a tenement in the impoverished south side of Glasgow. Now, as you may know, I know Glasgow well, as my mother's side of the family are from Brighton. And Glaswegians are renowned for their caustic wit. Was humour valued in your family?
Oh, absolutely. And it's so interesting, that business about being brought up in the south side of Glasgow. You were never allowed to get too big for your boots. And so part of the humour was about sort of cutting people down to size. But I also had an uncle who was an entertainer. And it's hard to explain just how this was. His name was Jack Connolly. He was actually otherwise known as Jakey Connolly. And his family had at one stage, for quite a short time, gone to Canada on one of those things where you could go on for, you know, very little money, because they were wanting migrants to settle in Australia or Canada. And he and his family had gone to Canada and not much liked it and found it pretty hard going, but they were right out in the in the far west of Canada, and he certainly learned to ride, and it was farmland, and these were folk who knew nothing about farming, I can tell you. So they came back to Glasgow, And my Uncle Jack, my first memory is as a child, was that when it was the May Day parade in Glasgow, was that my Uncle Jack was on a white horse wearing a Stetson and basically being like Roy Rogers. He used to lead this parade and he used to sing cowboy songs, and he was known as, and he used to affect a kind of American and North American accent, let's put it that way. And then, of course, when he was at home, he was as Glaswegian as the rest of us. He was a great comic and a source of great laughter in our wider family.
So there was sort of a showbiz show-off gene already running through the family, was there?
He actually had a very nice singing voice, and he ended up having a band, and he would play everybody on the South Side. We were the Catholic community of the South Side, and he used to play everybody's weddings and events and anniversary parties and all that sort of thing. And his daughters all could sing. Our side of the family, we were all very, very close. And there were four girls in their family and four girls in ours. And our four girls, we weren't very talented on the musical front at all. But I do think that we certainly loved the fact that we had this entertainer in our midst, and he was very, very funny. And my aunt and he had a double act where eventually he became a magician. And he used to do that thing where he'd take a half a crown from behind your ear, or he would take things out of his sleeves. And in Glasgow, of course, you'd have to be really good to be able to do that, because he would do it at schools and things when he was old. And the kids would shout out, "I can see, mister, where you put that handkerchief." And he would get very cross with his audience. But he was a great source of fun. And so I think the idea that you could deal with tough things by being funny was something I learned early on. And my mother was very witty and funny. And so I learned that you can use humor even when things are quite dark and when things are bleak. And you've just talked about us being brought up in the South Side of Glasgow in a tenement and so on. I was able in retrospect to look back and see that we were pretty hard up. But you know, when you're in the midst, when you live amongst people who are all this in the same boat, you don't think of yourself as being poor. And one of my sisters said recently to me, when I was, I'd been interviewed or something, she said, "Why do you have to tell people we were poor?" And I said, "No, it's just the reality. But there's no shame in the fact that we weren't well off." And my mother took great pride in the fact that she turned us out well. And I once went back to her house after I'd been interviewed in Scotland at the BBC. And the man who was then and became the sort of commissioner, one of the sort of main folk in the BBC, was a man called James Boyle. And he'd gone to the same school as me. And I went home and I said, "I saw James Boyle, and he's now the head of the BBC and whatever." And I said, and he said that his mother used to always say, "Those Kennedy girls are always so well turned out." And you know that my mother, forget about being a barrister, my mother thought that was the best thing that she'd ever heard about herself. You know, the fact that her girls were so well turned out, although it took a lot of hard work for her to take up hems and mend clothes and buy things secondhand in order to turn us out well.
It was a matter of pride, wasn't it? Because my family were the same, that you had to, with the little you had to show that you knew how to dress properly. We had a friend called Kim Kinney, who also grew up about a mile away in the East End of Glasgow. And he used to run the comedy store. And he was a wee man. I don't know if you ever met Kim, but a force of nature and a very funny man. And he ran the comedy store. He always turned out beautifully. And it was just, and it was kind of like your answer to the world was, you turned out beautifully, but you also used humour to even the playing field, do you think?
There is a strong Scottish thing, which is, it is quite egalitarian. I don't know what that's about. I suspect that maybe Presbyterianism, you know, we're all Jock Thompson's bairns, and that nobody was to be any better than anybody else. It was part of the culture. And I remember my mother, and it's something that stayed with me all my life, especially when I went to the bar, was that that she used to say, you know, never ever think you're better than anybody else, you know, that you didn't have look down on people. But she also said, and nobody's better than you. And we were brought up to feel that nobody was better than us. And so when I went down to study law in London, and then went to the bar, the bar has been, and it's only now that it's somewhat opening up, really, and thank goodness for it. But at that time, the percentage of women who were going into the profession was something like 5%. It was very, very low. I mean, there were hardly any women in my classes at all. And then going into practice, it was really low again. And you know, women's, it was just not the thing that happened for women. And certainly to be a working class woman, a girl who came from a working class background, that made me particularly rare. And so it was, humour was a way of dealing with all of that, you know. And I think that people often, when they're slightly an outsider, they can make themselves, you know, belong, I think, by being fun. And I think I learned that. And I think Glaswegians are very good at doing that. Well, I mean, one of my close girlfriends in Scotland is Elaine C. Smith, who's a real great...
Very funny, great funny comic, yeah, comic actress.
And she's very good at talking about that thing, about how one can use humour to sort of soften difficult circumstances. And I've always tried to introduce humour into my public speaking and into my work in the courts. And I've never, ever tried to lose my Scottish accent. I always felt that it helped in making a sort of bridge, for example, with juries, that you're not talking down to people, that you're actually communicating, you know, in a way that is has no grandeur about it, and where nobody's being patronised. And so I made my style of advocacy very different from what was the commonplace at that time in the 70s when I became a barrister, which was all terribly grand and war. And there was a sort of thing where, you know, suddenly in the midst of this, here was this woman with a Scots accent and who was from Glasgow. I do remember at one stage when I was, my practice developed quite fast, and I used to joke and say that every Scot that got arrested, you know, solicitors would say, why don't we get that woman? She'll be able to translate. And so I had, in the early days, had lots of Scots clients, and then it expanded where I had then the whole of the Celtic fringes, you know, I did lots of Irish cases. And you mentioned, I did some of the cases associated with the Irish Troubles. I did a lot of those big Irish cases. But I always remember one of the judges saying, ah, Miss Kennedy, when you say murder, it sounds as though there were more than one dead body. And so I used to think that sometimes it was an advantage for my clients and sometimes perhaps it wasn't. But by and large, I think that my work in the courts was helped by being a Scot and also by being somebody who was prepared to, you know, find a form of discourse that included humour.
That's really interesting. And I like it. I mean, but we talked about the south side of Glasgow, but that's a long way from the House of Lords and the barrister's chambers where you spend your time today. Are there any parallels between how the humour works in those two vastly different worlds?
You'll know this yourself. There are different ways of being funny. For me, it's always been much more about... I mean, I'm reasonably quick-witted, but I always find that more interesting thing is to weave it into a story. And so that is good storytelling. And that's what advocacy is about. That's what being a barrister is about, because it's really about telling your clients, giving your clients account, telling your client's story in the most compelling way possible. And often it's about... I quite like to use imagery to do that. And it's a bit like the prosecution will come and they will present their case. And I've often said to a jury, you know, sometimes it's a bit like what happens in a theatre, where the spotlight might be on what's happening on the stage, and you that's all that you see. You don't see what's happening around it, but you have to sort of then a moment could come where the whole stage is lit up and you see that beyond that area where the spotlight is, other things are going on, and that gives you a truer picture. And the defense lawyers, and I'm a defense lawyer, the defense lawyer's role is to really shift the perspective and to say, let's look at it in a different way. And then you present it in a way that is going to be most compelling and most perhaps hopefully helpful to your client. One of the things about advocacy is that you really have to leaven it, because if you're dealing with very serious stuff, there has to be ways in which you can somehow bring relief into it. And I know this from it's hard to find humor in things like, for example, violence against women and girls, you know, I mean, and I do a lot of my work's around that kind of thing. Nowadays, a lot of my work is international, and I'm looking at really grievous and terrible crimes, which are not just, I mean, crime of any kind can be terrible, but when it's on a large scale, then, you know, it's particularly depressing and terrible and affecting. And so how can you possibly be funny about some of this stuff? And the truth is that I always found it best to be funny about the judges, you know, and to tell judge stories. Or, of course, the House of Lords has given me a lot of material. Because, of course, it is such a peculiar, you know, institution in many ways. And so you find ways around, you know, when I want to talk to an audience about something serious, like violence against women and, you know, or whatever it is, you have to find the humor, not in the thing that is the central core of what you're talking about, but around the edges of it. And that is necessary in order to somehow leaven the full horror. And it doesn't diminish the horror. In fact, sometimes it can heighten it.
What humour does in that sense, and I really like your stuff because I think all the best humour is storytellers. I also happen to think that all the best communicators are great storytellers. And it's about that unique ability to connect with everyone, from the accused to the judge, from the cabbie to the lord, which you were just talking about. And how important it is being kind and compassionate as well as humorous in order to make that work.
The comedy that I always prefer is where you can get a sense that someone is not doing it out of cruelty. You know, I mean, you, Paul, are a great humorist. I feel the warmth that there is in you as a person, and I think people engage with that. They recognize that in a person. I think cruel humor is for me, it's unappealing. That business of putting somebody else really down and grinding them while they're down, and you know, the business of people's humor, which was racist or, you know, or diminishing women. I don't think you have to do that. You can still be quite funny. You know, you still can raise a laugh without having to be cruel.
But is that not the difference between playfulness? Because I actually think what at the centre of it is, you know, you have enough rapport, you have enough connection to be playful. And so you can therefore say things that are a little bit more cutting, because yeah, you've already got the warmth. And I think that's what the Glaswegian thing is about. I was the first time I did Top of the Pops, and slightly, and we all do this, you puff your chest slightly when you've done something. And I went up to Glasgow to see my cousins in Cranhill, and I went there. And, you know, I'd just done my first Top of the Pops, and I'm on tour, and I go and see my cousins in Cranhill, and all the wee cousins are there and went, "Oh, Uncle Paul, we saw you on that there Top of the Pops." And just allowed me to puff my chest enough and then went, "We thought you were a shite."
Oh, God. Well, there is certainly that Scottish thing, which is you must never get to think too well of yourself, because they'll bring you back down to the ground. And And I always remember that, you know, my sister said that she was in the street with my mother and somebody said, stopped my mother and said, "Oh, I saw something in the papers, Mrs. Kennedy, about your daughter and all the things that she does. I don't know how she does all that." And my mother said, I know, she's always busy, but you should see her skirting boards." And so basically, she may be great in the courts and she may be doing this and that, but all I can tell you, she's not much good as a housewife. I mean, you know, it's that business of, you know, never sounding as if you're being too overproud of your own children, and never letting your children think that they're too big. You know, they're getting too grand for. They've got to, you know where they're from.
Well, but you talk about children, and I know you have three children, and it's. Is that part of raise? Is it important to have humour in? You were raised with humour. Is it important to inherently plant that in them so they don't get too big for their boots?
My boys, particularly with each other, but also my poor husband is the butt of most of them. But I get some of it too. And when they're doing it with me, they put on this sort of Scottish accent, this full Glasgow accent, and they sort of go, "Oh, you know," and "Oh dear," and they take me off, you know. But their father is the person who suffers most in their hands. But no, there's a lot of laughter in this house, and I think we did get that really from my side of the family, that you know. That Scottish thing.
I think you also have to encourage it and allow it to happen, because it brings you back down to earth, because you will be in the House of Lords. There's not many places more grand than that. So you have to be rooted when you come home, don't you?
When I first took my mother's dead now, has been for 10 years, and she lived until she was 93. And she was really a rather marvellous woman. She was very funny. And when I first took her to the House of Lords and she looked around and she was saying, "I thought half these people were dead." You know, she saw lots of politicians that she remembered from the newspapers and things. And she said, but somebody had stopped her in Glasgow and said to her, "How do you feel now, Mrs. Kennedy, about your daughter being a lady?" And she said, "All my daughters are ladies."
Oh!
But it's that whole thing of just, you know, I don't make any difference between them. She was, but my mother was a real character. Very, very funny.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
woman?
My mother's 91. She won't thank me for saying that because she's been lying about her age forever, you know. But it's that humour as a resilience as well, because, I mean, what they lived through was quite extraordinary.
My father was in the army. My mother had two babies while he was away in those six years. I mean, when he came home on leave, he'd go back and she'd find out that she was pregnant. And she had these two babies, and she was living in a tenement in Tradeston on the south side of Glasgow, which was down on the river. And it was bombed regularly because, of course, you know, it was the shipbuilding area, and the tenement that she was in was bombed. And my mother went through the rubble. You know, she had her kids looked after by her mother-in-law for the day. She went through the rubble and found things, you know, photographs and stuff like that. And she found pieces of furniture, and somebody had given her a hand cart, and somebody else, the priest in the local Catholic church, had found some place that she could move into that was about 2 miles up the road. And she put that stuff on a hand cart, like mother courage, and moved up to find a new place to take her kids. You know, I mean, people went through the most incredible things. We don't know where I lie, really, that we hadn't that experience. But I just know, Paul, I'm on this task force advising on war crimes in Ukraine. And it's bringing me right up close to those kind of experiences that people did talk about what happened during the Second World War. Yeah, I wasn't born. I was one of the sort of post-war part of my family. My two sisters were 9 and 10 years older than me. But it was part of our lives hearing those stories about the effects of the war on people. And I think that a lot of men suffered terribly by the things that they experienced in the war, and then came home and sort of buttoned it up. And I think that, you know, they probably were experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder, and nobody knew. And of course, often, you know, drank too much and so on. I'm sure it had effects that were never at the time recognised, but were seen in social problems, you know.
I think that's very interesting. We had John Sweeney on the show, the Panorama reporter, and he's now in Ukraine. He spent the last year in Ukraine reporting from there. And we talked about, and you're talking about, the whole thing of dealing with these extraordinarily tragic situations. How important do you think it is to be able to see some humour even in the most tragic situations?
I've sat in the cells with people who've been looking at life imprisonment and sometimes got life imprisonment. And even in those sort of circumstances, people sometimes really, the toughest stuff in life, still people find a way of laughing at their own vulnerability or laughing at the... Yeah, and it is, you know, it is the humour of the gallows. It is the humour of the morgue. You know, I just this last week was with some very senior people from Ukraine. And like that, you know, the only way that you can remind yourself of life and find some enhancement in all of this is to believe in how the future might be. And so, of course, their jokes are all about Putin and what they want to happen to him. And that's how people survive. Survival is in finding that bit of ourselves that is, you know, that has lightness in it, and to bring light into dark places. And humor does that.
It's an escape as well. I mean, I'm the son of a Hungarian refugee who was, funny enough, at 17, put into the war, stationed outside Dresden, and then watched what happened there. Then joined up with the Russians because they spoke Russian, and went in 45 to Berlin with the Russians, and then was imprisoned. But all the time, he used to talk about how lucky he was, you know, because He said, we all got a fit of the giggles when we were lined up against the wall in 56 and the Russians shot people next to us. And he said, we were laughing uncontrollably because it was the only escape.
Yeah, people have to do that. I've just been involved last year in the evacuation of a whole lot of women lawyers and judges who were on a kill list for the Taliban. And I had to charter airplanes and things to try and get them out because they'd missed the military evacuation. They weren't part of that. And I was getting these calls in the middle of the night from women who were in their basements hiding because the Taliban were after them because they'd been the judges in cases they'd done or prosecuted them and whatever. And they were fabulous women. Well, let me tell you, again, these were women where sometimes women coming together who have been through bad things, you'll weep with laughter. You know, one of my women judges said, I when I was leaving and you had told me that we were to get ready and you asked us if any of us had burqas because we should put them on in case we were as we were being transported to the place where the airport was. And she said, I had banned the burqa from our house because the great thing was that we were no longer, after the Taliban were ousted in, you know, early in, you know, in 2002. And she said, and the idea that we were having to phone up relatives and saying, has anybody got a burqa? And, you know, it was, and we were laughing at it because one of my women judges, she as she was leaving the house, she said, and there were gaps, I said to them, the could only have one suitcase. I mean, it's the most terrible thing to be involved in. It was like Schindler's List. And I said to her, and what she said that she was leaving, and then she suddenly thought, they're not going to believe that I'm really a lawyer when I get to wherever I'm going. And so she went off and she got all her certificates and her diplomas and her degree certificate and stuck it down into her underwear. And she said, one thing I knew was, it was very unlikely that any of the Taliban were going to go putting their hands down into my underwear. I mean, they're women who found humour in the most awful circumstances, fabulous women, and I mean there they were looking death in the face. I mean, humour is something that I think is so, it's central to the human condition.
I couldn't agree more, and it's extraordinary the work you've done. But I think you've done that magnificent work partly because you can actually bring a lightness and a humour to it. You've spent your life giving voice to those with the least power within the system and championing civil liberties and promoting human rights. Do you think humanity and humour are closely aligned?
I think it's a strand of our humanness that we, in order to deal with the hard stuff, we reach for humour to kind of leaven it. I always remember, I mean, and if you can be quick, it helps. One of the stories I always tell was that I my life was very affected by getting to know an amazing American lawyer. He was a great attorney. And he was in Britain and he came to the Old Bailey to watch a case. And I was acting in a case for a group of anarchists. Now, and my client had been found with a book that was called, and this elderly lawyer was sitting at the back of the court and he watched me doing this thing. And then he befriended me and he and his wife became like like family to me. And so it did affect my way of thinking about law, and he mentored me. Well, do you know that when I was doing that case, my client had a book that was called The Anarchist Cookbook. And it was a thing that young people in the, you know, who were at university in those days had. It was a sort of, you know, it was a bit chic to have this book. And so I said to the police officer in cross-examination, I said, but look, you know, it's this is a coffee table book, isn't it, really? And the police officer says, not that I know. And I said, well, it's kind of, I don't know, you're probably too young to remember this, Paul, but there was an expression at that time which was radical chic. I said, it was a sort of radical chic thing to have this book. It didn't mean, and the judge said, pass that book up to me. The judge looks at it, and of course, one page is, you know, how to make mescaline and how to make amphetamine drugs and how to make a Molotov cocktail, a bomb, you know, all that sort of thing. And each page had some awful thing on it. And the judge is reading this out, how to make a Molotov cocktail. And he says, is this the sort of book that you have on your coffee table? To me. And I said, but my Lord, it's a bit like having the Kama Sutra. The fact that you've got it doesn't mean that you do all the things. Well, can I tell you something? The whole of the jury and everybody laughed their heads off. And the judge was furious with me. And then I got this note from this elderly lawyer at the back who was visiting, who was at the back of the court, saying, I think you're going to win this case. And I have to tell you, I did.
That's brilliant. What a fabulous story. I mean, do you really think that, because I would guess that it's true, and I think you've just given us a story that is true, that humour can sway a jury, or humour can bond you with the judge and the jury enough to actually influence a case.
There are people who were great humorists as advocates. There was a man called Gilbert Gray. He was one of the funniest people ever. Great advocate, but so amusing and funny. Great after dinner speaker. And Gilly, I did a couple of cases when I was a young lawyer, and he was the QC in the cases. And he was very, very funny. And there's a thing that happens in the bar mess. You know, that's where we all have our morning coffee and things. And it had that military name. I don't know how long it dated. But so in the bar mess, people used to talk about people. There were the few people who could laugh a case out of court. Now, laughing a case out of court is something that very few people could do. But there are some cases where, where the case is so ridiculous that you can take it to a level where the jury starts saying, this is ridiculous, we're going to acquit, because they feel that it's been a waste of public time. What's the point of all of this? And so on. And I remember there was a case where involving a dolphin. Alvin, it was in one of those sea places. Do you remember? And it was about somebody who was seen in a glass through the glass thing, a cleaner in the aquarium that looked through and saw one of the people who worked in the aquarium at swimming with dolphins. And he was holding onto the dolphin's one appendage that you could hold onto because they're all slippery on their bodies. And so if you were to swim with this thing, and so he was holding on to the genital area of this, and the suggestion was that he was doing indecent things with the dolphin. And the guy then said, it's not, and he said, and I was trained to do things with dolphins in the Caribbean or whatever. And it's the only thing that you can hold on to if you're trying to steer it away from, you know, whatever. And of course the jury acquitted it and thought, I don't care about what happens to dolphins. The cleaner should have kept her thoughts to herself, and instead of reporting this man to the police. Anyway, but it was a colleague who did that case, and I always remember weeping with laughter about his descriptions of how this case went and how this Newcastle jury sort of rolled their eyes to them and thought, is this what we're spending our time in court, you know, an offence against dolphins. So there we are. Think that, you know, there are people who can laugh cases out of court. I can't pretend that I'm one of them, but I certainly believe in bringing humour in.
I love the phrase laughing a case out of court, because of course what humour does is it gives you a different perspective. I mean, that's it, you look at it from a different way. And if you can get a jury to look at it from a different way, they can think about it differently. I just find that fascinating. Do you think that you can be a truly great communicator, whether that's as a speaker or whether that's as an advocate, without understanding humour?
I mean, there are people who are great advocates who can. There are people who are great jury advocates, and there are people who are very fine, judge advocates. And by that, I mean that the style is different. If you're in the Court of Appeal, you're doing a case and it's sheer, purely on the law, and it's not that often that judges on their own, you know, you have three judges up there, and if you're in the Supreme Court, of course, it's a whole bank of judges, then, you're not going to laugh a case out of court in those circumstances. You're there dealing with fine issues of law, fine distinctions. You're making an argument in a very different kind of way. The business of being a jury advocate, where you're putting a case in front of members of the public, and you're trying to, you know, deal with a set of facts, but in a legal context, there you've got much more license, and it's a different style of advocacy. Now, the really great lawyers are able to do both, but you know how to shift it. You know how to do that, make the difference. And it's, I suppose it's a bit like people who are in the acting profession or in, you know, who at times have to be doing, you know, Shakespeare, and other times can do, you know, light comedy. And I think that, you know, the best attorneys and the best advocates are able to do both. But there are people who really are confined to one or the other. And I know great lawyers who, as lawyers making legal arguments and distinctions and building up a legal argument, are wonderful, but you couldn't get a joke out of them even if you tickled them. You know, I mean, you know, that's not where their skill lies.
Isn't humour, in obviously this is a humorology podcast, but isn't humour the difference that makes a difference? It's kind of a superpower in one sense, don't you think?
I do. I mean, because even in front of that bank of seven judges, there are moments where, because of the seriousness sometimes of what you're doing, laughter becomes almost easier. People laugh at things that normally you wouldn't find that hilarious, but you can, because of the tension and the seriousness of the subject matter, then relief is found in laughter. And so, of course you do, you know, where... it's that business. It happens in the House of Lords as well, you know, where people can get, there are some people who are very good at playing the house, and there are other people who are just don't have that skill. And you know, it's always kind of, there's always a little bit of excitement when somebody, you know, is rather a performer, gets up to their feet, because you're sort of anticipating something different. But one of the things that's said in the House of Lords is, you know, everybody has said everything that can possibly be said on this subject except me. Repeating what we've all heard a whole set of times. And so there is that problem if people want to be on the record as having, you know, had their opinion expressed. But there are people, I mean, one of the funniest things in the House of Lords recently was that because of COVID, we all had to, technology had to be suddenly introduced into people's lives who were not particularly technologically skilled. And I do remember at one stage being in a queue for there's a sort of digital help room in the House of Lords where you can go and see these young techie guys who can help you when you've screwed up your technology. And I was standing in a line behind a very, very elderly peer, and I said to him, are you getting a website? Are you here to create a website? And he said to me, Elaine, I don't want a website. I want eyesight. And, you know, I mean, it's the whole technological thing has been such a challenge to an awful lot of people. But when the house was only operating online, and basically somebody was sitting on the wool sack in the house empty, and we were all in the little boxes on people's, you know, computers and zooming in, and you'd had to put, you know, indicate in advance that you wanted to speak, and so you'd be given that there'd be a lineup and so on, and so then the speaker in the house would shout out, Lord Gilly McGillicuddy of Upper Montrose, and then some ancient peer would appear in on the screen, and he would open his mouth and he would talk, and no sound would be coming out of him, and he would talk and talk and talk, and then the speaker would shout, Lord McGillicuddy, you're on mute. And then, of course, Lord McGillicuddy wouldn't know how to unmute, and you'd see him struggling with his computer. And then some ancient retainer would stroll in who would try and help them with the computer. And every presentation would take about 20 minutes. And so until we all became sort of technologically... And it was very interesting. You would see into people's houses, you know, you would see some very ancient earl, a hereditary peer in a castle somewhere, and you'd see on the back of his door hanging on a nail would be his dressing gown, you know, and he'd be in some ancient bedroom trying to communicate with the House of Lords. Anyway, it was a very interesting time, but it's made us all much more technologically equipped.
Well, that's it, and it kind of evens the playing field, doesn't it, that humour of, and that's why I go think about the humor and humanity, it's kind of, it starts from the premise of we're all ridiculous.
We know that it's part of the, isn't it part of our how we are as humans, that we see the ridiculousness sometimes in our behaviours?
I think that is the trick, because a lot of people who listen to this podcast are listening because they want tips and tricks for how to get their lives better. I get brought in a lot as a psychologist to help people with speeches and things. And one of the things is that happens a lot is people put other people on pedestals. You know, I can't talk to that Baroness Kennedy because she's way above me, rather than seeing them as people. And that's where I think the humour and the humanity come together.
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul. I think that if it's one of the ways in which you make those connections and you show that you're not any you know, you're any different from anybody else. You know, you may have a different job in life, but in fact, you're affected by all the same things, and you have all the same self doubts and all the same sort of concerns about it. You know, about our daily round, but you just try to be the best person you can be.
We couldn't fit everything into part one, so in part two, you will get more of her wonderful witticisms, her wonderful insights, and her wonderful charm and repartee. The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros, produced by David Rose, music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.